Welcome to EIR Talks. On March 21st of this year, a group of community leaders and political organizers gathered in Washington, D.C. to discuss a series of issues centered especially around the fight to prevent the takeover and shutdown of D.C. General Hospital. Lyndon LaRouche, who was running for the year 2004 Democratic presidential nomination, addressed the meeting via video teleconference. Here's Lyndon LaRouche, as introduced by Dr. Deborah Hanania Freeman.
On behalf of Executive Intelligence Review, I'd like to welcome you to today's seminar. My name is Deborah Freeman. I'm the U.S. Intelligence Director for EIR, and I also serve as Lyndon LaRouche's national spokeswoman. I think that, without question, the events of the last couple of days have left very little doubt that all of the institutions inside the United States, and in fact globally, will now experience more and more of the onrushing crises. And undoubtedly, if the events of the last week hold true, probably the nature and intensity of those crises will be far greater than anyone in the current United States government is prepared to deal with. Clearly, if we are going to deal with it, a change is going to have to occur. If it doesn't occur, then I think we can expect the absolute worst for the United States and for all of the nations of the world. But the fact is that there is an alternative. And I think that, indeed, the United States, in cooperation with our allies around the world, with the leading nations of Eurasia and of Europe, can, in fact, work together and move in a different direction to effect a true economic recovery. Clearly, the pathway to that has been defined by Lyndon LaRouche. Mr. LaRouche is now a registered candidate for the presidency in 2004, and he is without question the leading representative today of the American intellectual tradition, precisely the tradition which was responsible for resolving the crisis of 1933, and in fact, which is capable of addressing the crisis today. Without further introduction, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to present to you Mr. Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you, Deborah. We've now experienced the first disastrous 60 days of a new administration. Administration whose combined actions and inactions have pushed the world over the brink of the worst financial and economic crisis in modern history, as we shall soon see in the weeks ahead. This is far more dangerous than the financial and economic crisis that Franklin Roosevelt faced at his first inauguration 68 years ago, this month. However, the situation is not ended. The final word has not been said. I know many Americans better than they themselves do, at least in some important ways, relative to the questions at hand. There are relatively two qualities of Americans as a people which are specifically relevant to the present situation. First, the United States is one of the three nations or national cultures in the world which is capable of taking or assuming responsibility for the condition of the world as a whole. Those three cultures are, of course, the British Empire, which is really an empire, headed by the British monarchy. They're already pretty much intervening and controlling most of the affairs of this planet, including about 90-odd percent of the financial transactions occurring daily throughout the world. Even though the United States is probably the most powerful single economy as an economy, the British Empire is much more powerful as an economic and financial force than the United States. Russia, despite its coming upon bad times, has a national culture, which we are seeing with the development of the presidency of Vladimir Putin, a culture which impels it to step on the world stage as a world leader and initiator. No other nations or national culture of the world at the present time is capable emotionally and intellectually of assuming that kind of role of leadership. Asia has its own peculiarities. Continental Europe once had more important role in world history, but after two world wars and the so-called Cold War, that continental Europe is in very reduced circumstances politically. It still has much influence and interest, but it depends upon its partnership with leading powers of the world to make its policy. It will not initiate a global policy by itself. The other characteristic of the situation, the American situation, is that we are a nation characterized by an internal conflict, which is rather unique to our history. The conflict is typified by that between the American intellectual tradition, as typified by John Quincy Adams or Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, and to some degree Clinton. If he had lived, we'd have seen more of that. And on the other side, you have the tradition of the Confederacy. In the recent 35 years, since Nixon began his Southern strategy campaign for the presidency, an alliance of Wall Street finance and British finance, together with the legacy of the old Confederacy, has taken over the economic and social policy of the United States more and more. It is that change in our policy from about 1966 to the present, through Carter, through the other changes that have occurred, have led us down the road over about 35 years to the present global financial and economic disaster. Now the question, therefore, since this legacy, the legacy of the Southern Strategy, the legacy of Nixon, the legacy of Carter, the legacy of Bush as vice president, the legacy of Bush, the former Bush, as president, to a large degree the legacy of Gore and that faction inside the Democratic Party, that has led us down the road to a disaster. We've come to the point that we have a president who is not exactly known for his intellectual qualities, and is a complicated administration, which is based on some fanatics, religious fanatics and similar types, who are not quite in the real world. These are American Protestants, for example, who are very close to the thinking of Ariel Sharon in Israel. These are people who tend to be pro-Armageddon, pro the rapture. They don't think in real world terms, they think primarily in other world terms, and it's not necessarily another world we want to think about. We have a layer in there like Armitage and being nominated and others who are killers. They were associated with the former President George Bush in the Iran-Contra operations. They like to kill. They come up with programs that kill. And they're in there, the wild men, who think pretty much in the same direction as an Ariel Sharon. And they're lucky to get us into a Middle East war at this time anyway, if their influence prevails. We have another layer in the administration, typified to some degree by Colin Powell, but more so by Donald Rumsfeld and O'Neill and Cheney, who are old boys who come from the Republican circuits of the past. But they when they came up in their position, they represented what today is called the Rust Belt. Today, they don't work for the Rust Belt. They work for a Southern-based financial machine, typified by James Baker III, for example, which is the boss and which has taken over most of the nation and has played a key role in turning the northern states of the United States into the Rust Belt, into the ruin we've become. So some of these people are intelligent. But the situation is not entirely hopeless, because as you see in the recent developments, the fall of Alan Greenspan, which was inevitable. He's a man of an impossible man in an impossible situation. And sooner or later, that had to come to a conclusion. And it will sooner or later. I don't know exactly how. But the man he's got the mark of political doom written all over his career. But there are people who are concerned, and they're expressing this now. This system is not working. The Bush administration does not function. It is leading us into disaster. It is irrational. The California energy crisis keeps coming on. Other crises, energy crises come on. We have the breakdown of the healthcare system. We have the crisis in Washington, D.C. I have a virtual Negro removal program in Washington, D.C. to remove the D.C. General Hospital, which is the only full-service hospital in the area, which will deal with the population's needs in general. And they're shutting down that hospital, or attempting to do so, at a time when the world is faced with the spread of new epidemics, new outbreaks of epidemic and pandemic diseases of animal life as well as human life. We are destroying the capability we used to have in public health of dealing with that kind of threat. We are also killing people by economic policies which are destroying the healthcare system on which we used to rely. People are not happy with this. In Europe, especially in continental Europe, they're very unhappy with us in the United States, and for good reason. Some people in Britain are disgusted with what they see in the United States. I'm talking about influential Britons, not obscure people. They don't always have the best policies themselves, but they realize what we have going in the United States is a horrible mess, which is a danger to them as well as to the rest of the planet. On the continent of Europe, Europe for some years, continental Europe, survived largely because of the key role of Germany as an economy. Its exports was the margin by which all of continental Europe, or Western continental Europe, managed to keep going. Then it came 1989, 1990, and you had three people with bad ideas. One was called Margaret Thatcher, the meanest nanny that the British ever invented, the president of France, Mitterrand, who was a German hater, and George Bush. Now, George Bush didn't do as badly as he could have because he had a Vernon Walters, who was his ambassador over there at the time in Bonn, advised the president not to be stupid about this German reunification question. And the president, at least on that question, took his advice. But what they did is Thatcher demanded, and Mitterrand demanded, that the reunification of Germany shall not lead to a powerful German economy emerging in Europe. Now, by shutting down the German economy's potential for growth, which they did pretty much by their agreements in 1989-1990, they created a situation in which Europe today, continental Europe, is in a ruinous condition. Germany can no longer carry itself, its economy, let alone the rest of Europe on its back under the present circumstances. Now, there's one hope for Germany and for Europe. That hope is that Putin works, that is the new Russian president, that new agreements with Russia from Western Europe will lead to a partnership which will extend itself to East and South Asia and Central Asia. And thus, by building up the export or technology export capabilities of Western Europe, with Germany as the pivot, and with Russia as a partner in that pivot, it will be possible to enhance the long-term, say, 25-year term agreements between Western Europe, China, Japan, which is a really essentially a full-set economy too, Korea, and Southeast Asia. Under those circumstances, there's a 25-year long-term prospect for genuine economic growth in a post-financial crisis world. So the Germans know that. Other Europeans know that. They look forward to the possibility. But no German is going to make a policy today which bucks the United States. The German answer would be, we fought the Americans, the Anglo-Americans in two world wars, we lost them, we're not going to fight them again. So therefore, Germany has a very strong feeling about its vital national interests. It has a very strong feeling, as other continental Europeans do, about their vital national and continental interests. But they are not going to take an independent global initiative which directly challenges the power of the IMF and the United States and Great Britain. Therefore, the issue is, can the United States come to its senses, abandon the present policy which the incumbent president has adopted so far, and get into partnership with Western Europe, together with Russia, together with Asia, to build a Eurasia mobilization, economic mobilization, of about a 25-year immediate perspective, long-term technology export, and build the world as a whole, including Africa, which is hopeless unless we do this,
Central and South America, Australia and New Zealand, and build the rest of the world around a partnership between the United States, Western Europe, in cooperation with continental Eurasia. That's our opportunity. That's what many people in Europe today would agree to, at least as a general direction of thinking. That's what people in, I think, South and Central America would be very happy if the doors were open for that kind of alternative, as opposed to what they're getting from the United States and London today. So, can we do that? Well, my view is that with this system coming down, the whole financial and economic system in its present form is doomed. There is no way this can be fixed in its present form. We're going to have to write off trillions of dollars of worthless paper. It's already being written off by the market. I think, what was the latest one? American households and so forth lost $1 trillion recently on the financial bubble in Wall Street. There's not much money to go from there to go back into Wall Street. This system is finished. The collapse of the energy system, this deregulation crisis, is not simply a policy issue. The United States cannot live with Enron. It cannot live with that kind of deregulation of energy. We cannot live with the destruction of our healthcare system. We cannot live with the destruction of our infrastructure. We must put it back into order. And the present administration must simply give up the lunatic ideas. We say, okay, you were elected on a lunatic idea, so what? But now you're president, don't be a lunatic anymore. And pressures from inside the United States and from Europe coming together can put enough pressure on the institutions of the United States to bring sense to the United States. And as I said before, the United States is one of the few nations, of three national cultures on this planet, which can take the leadership initiative to push agreements through, not to dictate U.S. orders to the world, but to push through agreements among a partnership of nations to get some of the things done we have to get done quickly right now. That's our general situation. The other aspect of this, of course, is that we had a recent election. I don't even call it really a presidential election, because there really weren't any candidates. Nobody was actually running. They were running from something or for something, but they weren't running as candidates to run the United States, address it, solve its problems, and lead people out of the difficulties that were coming up. Gore was mostly running against himself. Bush didn't quite know who he was, except he was daddy's boy. They said nothing about the economic crisis. Nothing. They went through more than a year of primaries and a presidential election fight. They said nothing about the crisis that's destroying this nation and the world economy today. Nothing. They made no proposal. They said, we're doing fine. We have to have more free trade. More deregulation. We had to have more of the same medicine that was killing the world economy that's brought this depression crisis upon us now. It wasn't really an election. There was no participation by the voters in any discussion of policy. No candidates that were leading candidates were discussing policy. I was discussing it, but I wasn't allowed to get in the show. I was discussing policy. They weren't discussing anything. They were flapping their lips, saying how pretty they were. And they really weren't pretty, either of them. So it was an election campaign. The other side of it was what's happened to our people. Over the past 35 years, there's been a change in the temper of the American population. During the 1930s, as we came out of the Depression, during the war, during the 1950s and into the 1960s, the typical American had a lot of rugged individualists among them. People who might have been poor or not very wealthy. But they believed that their opinion counted. They believed that they had the right to discuss national policy seriously. They had the right to look over the shoulder of national leaders and criticize the way policies were being made. They had the right to judge whether somebody was fit to run for Congress or not. But they changed. The American people became more and more like a pack of human cattle. The lower 80% of the income brackets of the United States, which used to dominate the national income of the United States, have now fallen to far less than half of the national income. The conditions of life, you know them. You know how many jobs people work. You know how the problem of latchkey children. You know what's happening to the schools. You know what's happening to neighborhoods. You know what's happening to community structures. It's disintegrating. And what are the American people? They're like slaves. They think of themselves as like slaves. They vote like slaves. Oh, we can vote. And they go up and they knock at the back door of the typical boss, the guy who owns the big white slave mansion. And they say, we don't want our freedom, just give us some reparations. Give us a couple of shekels and go away. And so they go out there and they vote for candidates and support candidates in hope they'll get a couple of shekels. They don't fight for their life. They don't fight for their children's life, their future. They don't fight for their dignity. They fight for a few pitiful concessions. Esau was a hero. He sold out for a dirty bit, single mess of pottage. The Americans do it all the time, every time they voted. So the Americans didn't really vote. You will find that most citizens really didn't support the candidate they voted for. They were voting against the other guy. Bush had more support than Gore did. Without Clinton, Gore wouldn't have even been in the run. More people were voting for Gore because they were voting against Bush than voting for Gore. And now that the election is over and Gore is out, that fact is obvious to many people. Gore can do nothing for them. He's not president. He can't pass shekels out the back door anymore. There's no reason to vote for him. He's news. He's dead news. He's yesterday's newspaper. He's gone. So there was no election. The problem we have, therefore, is how do we get the American people to come back into the political process? Not as slaves knocking at the back door of the mansion trying to get a few shekels, trying to get reparations instead of freedom. How do we get the American people to realize that they, as people, have to act to save this nation and to save the world? How do we get them out of slave mentality to think like and act like citizens again? Well, first of all, you've got to give them some leadership, which gives them some confidence, which is what I'm trying to do. That's why I campaign. Someone has to stand up as a leading figure and say the things to the American people have to be told. They're not being told that. The press doesn't tell them that. Most leading candidates don't tell them that. They all go along to get along. They don't tell the truth. So therefore, my job is to present concepts, to organize around concepts and issues, and to say the things that have to be said, to try to convince the American people that if they can understand what I'm saying and can agree with it, or more or less agree with it, even if it takes a little mental energy on their part to do so, that they are perfectly capable of taking an initiative as a citizen to change the politics of the nation. Now, we have an operation going in Washington, D.C., this question of D.C. General. D.C. General, the last full-service hospital available to the population of the nation's capital. And a bunch of people tied to Katherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, and her crowd, who run Washington, D.C. like a private dictatorship, a private plantation. And the Washington Voice is the voice of the plantation slave master. Right? You want to get along in Washington? You go along with Katie Graham. That's the rule. Now, Katie Graham's crowd came up some years ago with a number of packages to beautify Washington, which means essentially get the African Americans out, or most of them, keep a few for show. How do they do that? Well, you take that Riverside down there where the D.C. General Hospital is located on, with the jail, the RFK Stadium. Now, go down and look at the maps. Look at the plans that have been made by Katie Graham's friends. Look at the organization that was created around that and around the idea of the 2012 Summer Olympics between here in Washington and Baltimore. Look at that. Look at the political action committees which were formed around these operations to buy up politicians, including Washington, D.C. politicians, and notable figures. to put money into their election campaigns to control the politicians. With the Washington Post as the press guardian, they saw the Goebbels press in Washington, D.C. to keep the people in line for Hitler. People went along with it. But what does it mean? If this goes through in Washington, D.C., you're going to have Negro removal to that great area of civil rights called Prince George's County in neighboring Maryland, where I understand a certain amount of killing occurs occasionally under rather dubious circumstances. You're going to have no health care for the greater part of the population of Washington, D.C., in a period in which epidemic disease is becoming a greater danger. But you're going to have some sightly speculative bubbles going up as high rises, casinos, marinas, and so forth, where there used to be a hospital and some other facilities. Now that's the point. Now, you take the people of Washington, D.C., the majority of the people of Washington, D.C., they're supposed to have some power, aren't they, on this thing? They're supposed to be able to control their mayor, control their mayor's office, and a few other things. Well, Katie Graham says they don't. They work for her. But if the people of Washington, D.C. would stand up as citizens and exert their druthers, this nonsense would stop. We might put some new architecture up there in that Riverside area, but it might be an improved general hospital, an improved school, or other facilities which are needed by the population of the nation's capital, for its people, and for visitors as well. That's the difference. The problem is a problem of mentality. If the citizens sit back and say, there's nothing we can do about it, we have to go along with the politicians who are controlled by Katie Graham, who Katie Graham and her friends have bought, who Katie Graham and her friends at the Post have brainwashed. They're not citizens. They're human cattle. And human cattle go where they're herded, don't they? But if they act as citizens, they say, wait a minute, this is our territory. You don't do this to us. You don't strip us of our health care. So we who do this kind of fighting, as we're fighting also on the national deregulation crisis, and other projects, our job is to get people to do what they must do, to think and act like citizens who have the rights given to them in name by the Constitution, to act in their own vital interests for the best interests of the nation, and to demand leadership or a competition among leadership which makes these issues clear to them and presents alternatives. And that's our problem today. That's our challenge today. And that's what I'm trying to do.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of Lyndon LaRouche discussing the fight for the general welfare in the United States. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Lyndon LaRouche addressing community leaders on the fight to save D.C. General Hospital and the broader battle to retain the right to constitutional protection for the general welfare of the population.
Now, what do we got? What are our options? We have, as I said, this option of a partnership between the United States. We've got to force into reality, Bush or no Bush. We don't think about the Bush administration. This is not a plantation. He's a president, not exactly an elected one, but he's a president, sworn in. And he doesn't own the country. The country owns the country under our Constitution. This country, this nation of ours, which if mobilized, that was mobilized for World War II, if it's mobilized, can decide that it's going to get into a partnership with our people we know in Western Europe with a project for developing Eurasia. The idea that if we can take the areas of Eurasia, such as China and India, which are the largest population centers of the world, which desperately need a more adequate inflow of high technology in order to meet the challenge of their future. You've got most of the people of India are desperately poor in unimproved conditions. The interior of China has not yet been developed. The Chinese population will grow inevitably. Without infrastructural development, which goes beyond the scope of the existing outpouring of technology, the internal problems of China cannot be adequately met over the coming period. Without the same thing for India, India cannot deal with the problem of its mass, its unresolved mass of poverty among the overwhelming majority of its population. We have in Indonesia, with the blessing of the United States government, is disintegrating. We can't have that. Southeast Asia is threatened. We can't have that. We have the northern part of Asia, which is in Siberia, including a vast tundra area, and Central Asia, partly a desert area, mostly underdeveloped, thinly populated. It's one of the great growth area potentials of the world. It needs infrastructure. It needs technology. This is one of the, it has immense resources, but we don't have the ability to develop those resources without infrastructure. So therefore, if you think about the vast continent of Eurasia, the largest part of the human population, the center of the earth in terms of human existence, and if we decide that we're going to enter into long-term cooperation to develop that in the same way that we approach the question of rebuilding Western war-torn Western Europe between 1946 and 1965. Using the same, what with lessons we learned from that, maybe on a larger scale. That is a great mission for the United States as well as for Eurasia. If we build up the rate of growth on this planet with that kind of cooperation, we can meet the needs of Central and South America, and we can finally give justice to an Africa which in its so-called Black African region is subjected to genocide, chiefly run by British figures such as Linda Chaka from London and her office, which has a plans, detailed plans of genocide for all of Black Africa, supported in part by American interests which are working with London on these Africa projects. You see, the genocide in Africa. People talk about Africa this, Africa this. Most Americans, including African Americans, don't know anything about Africa. The stronger, more strongly they express the opinions, the less they know about it. I know something about it. I have friends all over Africa who are dying all the time now. They face a reality which is not being faced among African Americans. So when some African American says, you got to be concerned about Africa, I say, I'm concerned. Why aren't you? They say, we're talking about this. Well, you're not talking about reality. You have to talk about British and American genocide targeting Zambia, Zimbabwe, Burundi, what's happening out with Museveni in Uganda, what's happening with all these parts of Africa where civil war, where it's being carved up into microstates run by foreign companies, big companies like older George Bush's Barrick Gold, Barrick International, which are running mercenary armies and killing people en masse, tearing Congo apart. That's genocide. We can do something about that. If we start to rebuild this world, we can finally bring justice to Africa. We can solve the problem similarly easily of Australia and New Zealand in that context. We just have to have the will to do so. So our hope is that. Also, there are some other things we have to do. The present inventory of technology on the shelves of our manufacturing facilities and laboratories is not adequate to meet our needs. People talk about a space defense system. They don't know what they're talking about. The only kind of real conflict you could have between among powers today would be through the aid of submarines planting some pods off the shores of the United States and Russia and threatening to send up some nuclear devices which will cause electromagnetic pulse effect, which will shut down most of the United States economy, except for the hardened part, for some time to come. And the same thing would happen to Russia. That's the alternative to thermonuclear war. Yeah? And that would, the alternative is to go to thermonuclear war. But that's the alternative, and that's where we're headed. That's the real issue. All this talk about rogue states and so forth is bunk. It's not true. The biggest rogue state I know about is Sharon's Israel. That's the one you got to worry about. They're the ones that threaten to set off a whole world war in the Middle East right now. We don't have this fantastic technology that people talk about. But we have to develop it, because we do not have the scientific progress we need presently to meet the ongoing demands of the world. I mentioned this problem in China, this problem in India, problems in Central Asia. We have ideas of what to do. There was a great fellow who died in 1945. He was a great scientist. His name was Vladimir Vinatsky. He's famous internationally as the founder of a branch of physical science called biogeochemistry. And most of what we think about the world today in terms of infrastructure, in terms of biosphere and so forth, are based on ideas which are centered around people such as Vinatsky and his influence. We have areas of research, including space research, from which we can generate the new kinds of technologies needed to increase the productive powers of labor and solve the problems of humanity over the coming period. So what I think, in conclusion, what we have to have is a sense of national mission. The idea of the United States cooperating with Western Europe and Eurasia as a whole to restart the world economy, the idea of taking that on as a 25-year long-term credit mission, rebuilding a new financial system like the old Bretton Woods system to handle the kind of problem we faced in the immediate before period, the same general kind of lessons, and then getting a science driver policy to expand the scientific work in our universities, to build the laboratories, to get the new projects, the new technologies, the new productive technologies, the new products in place, and to think about rebuilding this world, and to be able to tell our children who come 25 years down the line, what we're going to do for you is we're going to give you a better world. That's what we're doing now. If we can get that concept across among enough Americans and others, I think the citizens of the United States will return to the American intellectual tradition which Franklin Roosevelt invoked in his election campaign of 1932, and which he utilized in his struggles against the Southern tradition, the Coolidge tradition, between 1933 and his death in 1945, and used that revived American intellectual tradition on which our nation was founded in cooperation with other nations of the world. Let's rebuild this planet. And let the American citizen stop thinking of himself as a poor person here or there. Think of himself as a citizen of a nation which is doing that. And let him take or her take pride in being a citizen of such a nation with such a commitment. If we can mobilize that, we can save this nation. We can save this world from one horrible mess. And that's what I propose we ought to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Lynn, the first question that we have is actually from a Japanese journalist. His question follows. Mr. LaRouche, during this week's visit of our Prime Minister to the United States, he and his party were asked many not-so-friendly questions by the American press, implying that Japan's economic policies were a big cause of the current crisis of the U.S. and global financial markets. Since Japan's policies, which have not for sure been good, were mostly insisted upon by the Washington consensus and by U.S. investors in the IMF, I wonder if this is very fair. First, could you please comment on the real cause behind today's market crisis, which all this talk maybe is somewhat covering up? And second, could you also tell us what positive role Japan could play to help create some solutions or ways to overcome the current world economic problems?
Well, the problem of Japan's role in the world crisis today goes back a century to the Nixon administration. That during the 1970s, Japan was still a high technology exporter on long-term largely to the third world, so-called. There are two cases which exemplify that. One was the case of Iran in the 1970s, and the other was a case of cooperation between Mexico and Japan. In the first case, the Shah of Iran had reached a general perspective with Japanese cooperation to of oil for technology swaps, under which Japan or Iran would become a kind of Japan, an industrialized nation of Central Asia. This Japan was told no. The Shah was told no. The Shah was told he would be killed if he refused to break off the deal, and he was later killed by the people who told him to get off it, like including Henry Kissinger. Japan backed off. The second case, in the case of Mexico, Japan had a long-term agreement, typical of many of its agreements of that period, to export Japan high technology, especially heavy technology, to developing sector countries in return for things like petroleum or raw materials. So there were these product for technology swaps, and of which long-term credit was extended by Japan for purchased technology in return for agreement on raw materials or something else. For example, soybeans from Brazil, or that sort of thing. The United States said no. Now, this got nasty about the time that the Carter's owner, Brzezinski, got involved as national security advisor and general factotum of the Carter administration. And Brzezinski ordered the Japanese to break off the deal with Mexico on oil for technology. The Japan was going to provide steel mills and other things for Mexico in return for a long-term agreement on export of petroleum to Japan across the Pacific. Brzezinski said to Japan, "You will not take Mexico oil. You will take Alaska oil." Huh? And that was that. So as a result of these kinds of policies, Japan, whose natural interest is essentially to find markets, especially with its neighbors, China if possible. China is extremely important to Japan, even though there are certain difficulties between Japan-China cooperation. Korea is extremely important in this. Southeast Asia is extremely important. What's happened in the history of Indonesia since the 1960s is an example of the problems that arise in this. But Southeast Asia in general. What happened to the Philippines? Japan lost a lot of money in the Philippines when Marcos was overthrown by the United States. This is part of the situation. So Japan was thus put in the position where the United States during the 1980s said to Japan, "Don't export to third world countries. We are against that. You will now concentrate on markets in Europe and especially the United States." So Japan concentrated on the consumer and related markets in the United States and Western Europe, especially the United States. Now, in this process, what the United States did, especially since the time of the Plaza Accords Agreement in New York City, was that Japan was using its yen in what became eventually the yen carry trade. Now, can you imagine a country which is loaning money, its money, overnight at about 0% interest? It's now about 0% interest. Overnight. To big speculators, what do the big speculators do? They borrow the money. They borrow the yen. They turn around and use the yen to buy European currencies and dollars especially. So therefore, what's happened is that Japan has been driving itself into bankruptcy with a financial policy imposed by the United States, but imposed so that Japan would subsidize the United States. Now remember, how does this work? The United States has been running recently on a major current account deficit. This is partly a result of our so-called globalization and free trade policies. Therefore, we no longer produce our own products, less and less. We ship the products out to cheap labor markets overseas. We destroy our own industries. We cut down the incomes of our own people by shutting down their jobs in order to bring in cheap goods from cheap labor and other foreign markets. The result is that since we don't earn money anymore, or earn much less, we are getting imports from cheap labor markets and other markets on credit. Where does the credit come from? It comes from places like the yen carry trade or the euro carry trade, where vast subsidies of printing press money are poured in with an inflationary effect into the world economy in order to subsidize the U.S. economy, which can no longer maintain its own standard of living on its own earned income. That's what the current account deficit means. And there's some other factors as well. So Japan is being destroyed. And the effect, in effect, what the United States government is saying, the nastier types, to countries in Asia, if you don't do as we tell you, if you buck the IMF, we'll kill you. That is personal assassinations of heads of government and states, or similar kinds of Christmas presents. That's the way it's run, by muscle. And that's what's happened to Japan. Japan is threatened. Japan is told, well, you have a security problem. You do as we tell you, or we'll crush you. That's what the United States said on Colombia. The United States government ordered the Colombian government to push drugs, to legalize drugs, and destroying Colombia. The United States government is supporting drugs throughout the Central and South America. Why do the Peru government allow the drug pushers to crawl back into power in Peru? Because the United States government, at the point of a gun, in this case, Madeleine Albright's gun, said do it. And Japan is getting the same kind of treatment. People have to realize the way that certain people in the United States, especially from the American Tory party types, use things such as the Justice Department, or certain sections of the Justice Department, certain sections of the military, not the CIA, the military, the Special Warfare Division of the military, which does assassinations and things like that if you want them done. And going around to various governments of the world and saying, you do what we tell you, or else. Or as George Bush, the president, would say, if you don't do what we tell you, there may be consequences. Just like they used to have in death row in Texas, and so forth. And that's the problem. The interest of Japan, and the actual interest of the United States, is for Japan to revive its role as a full set economy, to play together with the United States and Western Europe a key role in supplying the and Korea as well, a key role in supplying the technology which is immediately required throughout Eurasia as its big market, and also to do similar things in other markets of the world where Japan products are suited for that purpose. So Japan should essentially be able to reorganize its financial affairs by a sort of what we might call the equivalent of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy reorganization or whatever needs to be reorganized, and to go back to the business that its national interest dictates, if it's allowed to do what is in its national interest. And that is to find agreements, largely in Eurasia, the biggest market of all, find those agreements, use Japan's potential as a full-set economy to supply a complement of that high technology which Asia needs to find justice, and the rest of the world as well. The problem is, you have a regime in Washington which is absolutely hysterically desperate. They say, we don't care what it costs you to Japan. We are not going to change our policy. We are not going to admit that the United States may be going into a collapse, financial collapse. We're not going to admit it. You are going to put your babies up the hawk or whatever else you have to do to get that last shekel into the United States to support the Bush administration's policy. And if you don't, we'll do something bad to you. Look at the case of Maury. Someone in the United States said, Maury's got to resign. The prime minister. You know, a leading influence, the United States goes to a sovereign country, an ally, a partner, Japan, and says, we want the prime minister fired. The prime minister said they ran an effort inside Japan to have him impeached, his government recalled on a vote of confidence. That didn't work. They said he should resign anyway, U.S. press, from the State Department and other places. He should resign. He's going to resign. We predict he'll resign tomorrow. He said, I'm not going to resign. And they keep doing that. You do that to a country which you show respect? Do you think you're winning affection in Japan by trying to do that to Japan? Americans should find out what their government is doing. this case of the United States' treatment of Japan. Remember, Japan and the United States together are the linchpin of the international financial system. And the United States want to club Japan to death? Idiots. That's the problem. Now, this is not, there's not a lack of understanding of this in some places in Europe. And as I said before in my remarks, given the craziness, the idiocy shown by this current administration, and wasn't always not perfect before then, as you may know, the people in Europe and the United States and elsewhere have got to realize we have a problem. The stupidity of present U.S. policy must not continue. And don't tell me that George Bush is president and he's setting policy. What about then the United States? There's something higher than the president of the United States. That's the United States. Maybe powerful people in the United States, together with powerful people in Europe, people of influence, and with consent and agreement from other people in other parts of the world, should descend on Washington, in effect, and say, cut this nonsense out. You cut it out. And there, if their concert of power from within the nation, the United States and Europe and some other countries, is sufficient. So if the right number of all boys get together and descend on the United States and say, cut this insanity out, then the insanity will be cut out.
I mean, I believe that the AFL-CIO and the unionists and of all levels, rank and file all the way up, realize that there is no one with a plan except you. And I guess I'm here to ask you, how do I go about trying to make this happen?
Look at the D.C. hospital. There is no, particularly with what's happening to the pension plans of unionists today, the question of health care and pensions is crucial, and health care is a key part of it, the health care available. So a case like the D.C. General Hospital is not simply a Washington case. It's a case of a fight for the general welfare. Now, the labor movement actually was, as it developed in its new form under Roosevelt's period, was a key part of the fight for the general welfare. That was the basis for the formation of the committees of organization with John F. Lewis in the 35 and so forth organization. Was a fight for the idea that the labor movement was not a trade association, but it was a fight of working people for the general welfare, knowing that the defense of the general welfare is in the interest of all of them. So therefore, you fight for a higher principle and then come in, having won the principle, to claim your rights under the principle. Whereas in many American campaigns, people go in and campaign for what they want as their goal. They don't campaign for the principle. And when they don't get the goal, they don't get the principle, they don't get anything. And the way you get a principle across is by getting more people to support it because it is their principle, not just your particular goal. So therefore, issues like the D.C. General Hospital are fighting issues because they involve the question of national health care policy, as in this case, directly involving the federal government, the Congress, which is in control of the Washington, D.C. area. So therefore, what is done in D.C. is done to the entire nation, because the agency that does it is the Congress. And don't let the Congress say, we go along to get along, somebody else handles it. The Congress is responsible as a body for whatever any part of the Congress does. One part of the Congress cannot get by with this committee game. The Congress as a whole, with its conscience, is responsible for whatever the Congress does. Now, second thing for this question of energy policy, regulation, re-regulation. The labor movement's biggest loss was under Carter, after phase one and phase two under Nixon. Deregulation. What destroyed the trucking industry? Deregulation. What happened as a result of deregulation of the trucking industry and of the railroad, breakdown of the railroad system? That towns and cities which had places of employment, industries, could no longer get equal rates and schedules for shipment of their goods, their outgoing goods and incoming goods. They were squeezed out of business because they couldn't get on-time delivery at prices they required. Result was the trucking industry was broken. We know what's happened to the truckers. It's a nightmare, the whole trucking industry today, as a result of it. The energy question as such. Look what's happening in California. There is no solution except re-regulation. So the two issues which I put up front, DC General and the question of re-regulation, are issues which involve everybody, and they involve one common principle, the principle of the general welfare. What are we up against? All right, what is the problem? We have a Stone Age majority of the Supreme Court, typified by Scalia. The Stone Age majority says there is no general welfare. They say there's shareholder value, which is the equivalent of slaveholder value. That no one, trade union or anyone, has any rights under that Supreme Court majority, because shareholder value will dictate everything. So therefore, I would say that the way to do this is to say we have a movement, which is a movement, a revival of the American intellectual tradition, concretized as a fight for the general welfare, and concretized by mobilization of people throughout the country on specific problems which typify the fight of the general welfare, which they can recognize. Because, as they used to say in the labor movement, justice for one is justice for everyone. And that's the way we have to go at this.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. This concludes our presentation of Lyndon LaRouche and the battle for the general welfare of the population. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.